Whether we think about it much or not, we negotiate all the time. Over the kids' bedtime, which movie to see, the price of a house we'd like to own or one we'd like to sell, a wage increase, the beginning or the ending of a relationship. All of these involve some sort of negotiation. Now, the kids' bedtime is a small one, yes, and if negotiations break down tonight, they'll probably succeed tomorrow or the next. But what if wage negotiations break down, or the most delicate and highly charged negotiations involved in separating from a long-term relationship? When they break down, the parties may end up in court. Is that step necessary or always advised? Are there options between breakdown and litigation? In non-litigious situations, does breakdown have to mean slamming of doors? Good afternoon. I'm Susan McGinnis, and I've invited two people who have experience in the worlds both of negotiation and mediation to talk with us about mediative options, which can open slam doors and either keep us from court or, if court is inevitable, simplify the process of a legal settlement when the courts will be involved. Patty Kostelic is the Director of Student Services for the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She's worked for years in official and unofficial capacities as a mediator. Terry Foster Brimner is a Fairbanks attorney in private practice here, specializing in family law. She has recently opened a branch of sorts of her private practice to specialize in mediation, in divorce and custody issues, and other issues relating to her field. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining me and welcome.
Hi. Thank you. Good afternoon.
I want to spend as much time as we can during this hour talking about mediation, but I think we need to set the table, so to speak, talking a little bit about negotiations and how we go about it in society, casually and formally, but even before that, beginning with conflict. Conflict, it feels to me, is like change. It's the only constant in our lives. Can I have opening thoughts from either?
Well, I,
Patty,
this is something that when I do training on mediation, and in fact when I start a mediation, I always validate conflict as an inevitable for the people that I'm working with or the people that I'm training. I think it starts with our families. The kinds of ways that we choose to deal with conflict very much are learned when we're children. I was married to someone once whose family, their style of dealing with conflict was absolutely to avoid it. There was lots of conflict, lots of disagreement about lifestyles, values, generational change, and so on. They had a long list of unspoken issues that they simply would not deal with in order to preserve peace in the family. Because if we talked about them, people would get angry and we wouldn't know how to solve them, and so they just avoided it.
The whole house would blow up.
Right. Yeah. Some, what I would make a judgment to be very healthy families have very good ongoing processes for dealing with conflict. They'll sit down when they get to an impasse and say, okay, your behavior is causing tension in this house. How can we alter this? And they'll sit down and have a family powwow and work it out, and hopefully work it out in a long-term way. Some people come from families that are very voluble, and they are used to screaming at each other, and there aren't very many aftermaths from that. They're comfortable with a knockdown, drag out, verbally I'm speaking of now. And everybody puts their words out in the air, and once they've been heard, everyone sort of calms down, and that's their style. But if you mix those styles, you can really get into difficulty.
Well, I would agree, Patty, that the first of all, conflict is inevitable. It's part of human nature. It's part of certainly in our society where we encourage a pluralistic society and encourage differences. You know, it'd be silly to even talk about whether or not conflict is present or necessary. Mm. I think that clearly what's important is how you deal with conflict and what you do with it in healthy ways versus unhealthy ways of dealing with it, and also a variety of ways to deal with it, because there's different kinds of conflict, there's different levels of conflict, there's different kinds of people that are engaged in conflicts. An institution being engaged in a conflict with an individual is different than a husband and a wife engaged in a conflict, or a parent and a child. You know, I mean, and we could talk on forever about all the dynamics of those combinations, but the point is you need to have a variety of conflict-solving approaches because you've got different kinds of problems, different groups of people, and different issues.
Mm-hmm. To put it in some categories, just so we're all talking about the same thing, one of the things that I use when I'm doing training is to talk about ways of dealing with conflict. the classic way, of course, is competition. And there are sometimes that's probably the only way to deal with it. Let me give an example in a workplace. If there's a team working on a project and they've got a problem that they need to solve, and there are two or three different, fairly substantially different approaches to solution, they may compete for their individual solutions and hopefully give a very good presentation, and then a choice will have to be made for one of those solutions. That's a sort of nonviolent conflict competition. The classic example, of course, is war, where people are fighting over a border or over a religion, and one or the other, the only way the people involved see that one or the other may prevail is to compete. The other way, of course, is the first example I used, which is to avoid it entirely. And depending on the situation, and I want to stress this, depending on what the situation is, as Terry indicated, there isn't anything inherently wrong or bad about any of these approaches to conflict resolution. It just depends on the situation, the nature of the conflict, the dynamic of the conflict. So you can avoid it. You can also accommodate conflict, saying, well, this is not very important to me and this problem, we're in conflict about it, but I just as soon give in to you on this issue because either I don't have the time to deal with it or I don't care about it as much as you do.
I don't care which movie we go see tonight. You decide on the house and I'll decide on the furniture, sort of.
And sometimes that's to say, well, maybe later on down the line I'll get some chits of my own. I'm giving in here. The classic one, and one that people sometimes confuse with what I consider to be real mediation, is a compromise. And really, compromise implies that there is a pie that's big enough to divide, and often compromise involves me giving up something and you giving up something in order to live peacefully. And there may be some residual problems with that. Some things are easily compromised about and other things are not. And then, in my mind, another way to deal with it is to negotiate or mediate so that we both can understand each other very well and come to some kind of joint or shared solution that can be enduring.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Introductory statement of sorts. Have you thoughts on that, Terry, before?
Well, just one thing, I suppose, which may be jumping ahead a little, but it seems to be a corollary to what Patty was just saying, and that is that sometimes you have to, before you even start talking about mediating or negotiating or dividing the pie, really look at what the conflict is, because in fact there may not be a conflict in the classic sense of opposing ideas that cannot both occupy the same space, and that's when you certainly have to compromise, divide the pie. Sometimes the conflict that presents itself is a mask for another conflict, mm-hmm. and it's real important. I mean, it may seem elementary, but first to identify the true conflict, because in fact what you may have is a situation where both people can have what they truly want. They're not incompatible, but what they are arguing about or what they think they want appears to be incompatible. So that's even a process, too, of not only talking about, well, first of all, we accept that conflict is there. Second of all, I think we need to identify what the true conflict is. Right. Then we move forward to, okay, what are the varieties of ways we can look at solving this particular conflict with this particular pair of combatants, for lack of a better word?
In this country, the official body for settling conflicts is usually the court of law, the legal system. Do you have thoughts on where it functions best and where it doesn't function well in terms of the kinds of conflicts we've been raising so far this morning?
Well, yeah, and sort of historically, the court of law was the thing that evolved from physical combat. The strongest prevails, the knights clashing on their horses, those types of things. You know, became an unsatisfactory way to settle disputes. And we evolved to the, you know, for our purposes, the English system of courts of law, and that's a very satisfactory, civilized way of handling disputes because of the lack of physical combat. The use of attorneys or advocates is there to equalize or help equalize the power imbalance that sometimes exists between people with disputes. So it seems fair. And again, without going into all that historical, we arrived at that system which felt very good as a conflict resolution system. what we did then was sort of stop, because it worked so well so often. We stopped looking at other things, and we started pouring every conflict we had in our society into that system. And as our society in the 18th, 19th, and now 20th, 21st centuries got incredibly more complicated, and we were presented with new issues faster than our social structure could keep up with them, we kept pouring it all into the court system. And pretty soon the court system is not overloaded in terms of volume, it's overloaded in terms of capacity to handle the kinds of things presented to it. The kinds of things that the court system does well are sort of classic contract disputes. Criminal law, I think, is still for the most part handled very well within the court system, where you have advocacy for two competing points of view, and the theory is that the truth will emerge from vigorous competing advocacy and the use of the juries to sort of independently evaluate and pass judgment. Where it doesn't work well, and I like to analogize it to our school systems, where we sort of done the same thing. We developed a very good system of public schools, and then we started pouring more and more things into the schools other than just teaching the basics of reading, writing, and arithmetic. We started pouring more and more obligations into the schools, you know, for two reasons. One, because there wasn't any other place to get it done that we felt good about, and we had some consensus that certain issues were important to be resolved. With the school system, the one I like to use or talk about is sex education. We've really put that into the school system as saying we need to have it done. Mm-hmm. It's not getting done in the homes and churches and other places where it should be done, so we try to pound that round hole into the square peg of the school system. But what we've done is we've taken a very value-laden issue and put it into a very supposedly value-neutral system. And then we wonder why it doesn't work. You know, go back to the court system, we're doing the same thing. We have a system that is designed to do certain things, and we're now throwing more and more other disputes into it that it's not able to handle effectively. In my own field of domestic relations and family law, divorces, custody questions, I find that in many cases those do not fit neatly and comfortably into the classic model of the adversary system that our court system is built on. So then you have to question whether the results we get out the other end are valid results. Mm-hmm. Or at least, if they're valid, are they the best we can do? And for me, then, what you need to do is you say, okay, let's start looking at other ways to resolve these disputes. The disputes clearly exist. They're clearly important. They're clearly disruptive to society if we don't resolve them. What's a better way to resolve them? Ultimately, I think the court system has to remain there to resolve them if we can't do them in some other way. I'm not saying you take them away from the court system, but look at the options of diverting them, or, as you said in the beginning, simplifying the issues maybe before we get into court.
Do you see, Patty, an evolution, and again, we're going to talk about the thing we're not talking about yet, but an evolution of our conflict-settling systems to include and embrace mediation, largely for the reasons that Terry's just presented?
Yes, I do. California, Massachusetts now have community mediation. That's a formal part of the court process for certain kinds of disputes, neighborhood disputes, community disputes, certainly all civil law. No, we're not talking about criminal law now. Mm-hmm. And the judge remands the conflict to the mediation system for hopeful resolution. And, of course, if it can't be resolved with that method, then it can come back to the courts. And so I think we're going to formally move towards it, principally for the reason that Terry said, that differences in values and beliefs, the court really isn't designed to work through that. And I think it's one of the major sources of conflict. One of the things that is frustrating for people when they go into the court system, it's really set up to find someone who's right and someone who's wrong. They're going to find for someone. And when it's a conflict that's about values or belief systems, that's not very satisfactory. Your values and beliefs are your right. They're part of your culture, part of your family upbringing. And I think one of the reasons that we see such an increase is we no longer live in homogeneous neighborhoods where there's a shared value and belief system. Certainly, it's my experience at the university that I'm dealing with students from a broad range of cultures, backgrounds, expectations. We're no longer dealing with universities that are training young white males, 18 to 21, who all come from basically Protestant families that had a shared value system. So we are having to work through, in a way, more discrepant value systems. And the court, because it presumes that everyone is equal under the law, tends to collapse those differences in a way that at least is emotionally unsatisfying sometimes for the participants in the conflict.
We're talking today with Patty Kostelic, Director of Student Affairs for the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and also a mediator both officially and unofficially, and with Terry Foster Brimner, who is a family law attorney in private practice in Fairbanks and has recently opened a branch, and I say that kind of in quotes because it's in the same place, of her business in mediation. Terry, you were about to say.
Well, I just wanted to say before I lost the thought that Alaska statutes do provide for divorces to be mediated in a limited sort of way. There's a statute which says that upon the request of either party to the court, they can order the other party to submit to mediation. And, you know, there's a minimally defined process for selecting a mediator. But the other party only has to go once. So it's sort of, maybe a compromise between somebody who wanted a statute that would require mediation and someone who realized that you can't require mediation when you have two people who aren't committed to it. But there is that provision, and what it means is that early on in the case, say, for example, the husband could ask the court to order the wife to go to mediation. She has to go once. Mm-hmm. The hope is you get him in the door once. Maybe you can grab him and continue. My experience is that statute is rarely used. I've only had one time when the other party requested and, you know, ordered one session of mediation. The parties usually either voluntarily choose to go that route or they don't. But it is available, and I wanted people to be aware of that.
I think most of us... I'm sorry, Susan.
Go ahead.
I think most of us know couples that started out a dissolution of their relationship, regardless of whether they were going for a divorce or dissolution, but came to the point where they believed that it was the end. And if they weren't happy with that, at least they were reconciled to it. And then came the dividing of the property and so on. And in order to do that, everybody is advised to go and get a lawyer. Now, even the best, most right-thinking, moderate kind of lawyer is being hired to do the best for his client. And so I personally have a lot of experience with friends who were quite civil to each other before they went into the actual divorce process. And then in the process of each hiring a lawyer and being encouraged to fight for the most optimistic amount of the spoils that they could get, ended up becoming very adversarial and, in fact, not even speaking to each other, and became increasingly bitter. And I'm not necessarily blaming the individual lawyers who are working on behalf of their clients, but had they gone into a mediation process, as Terry describes, maybe they could have worked out something that was more mutually beneficial and resulted in less conflict aftermath.
A classic example of where the court system may not be best suited because it is an adversarial system. It's supposed to be that way.
Well, and the attorney has an ethical obligation to the client, to themselves, to their profession, and assuming that the attorney is trying to meet that. You know, I don't necessarily agree that every attorney, in defining how they meet that ethical obligation, encourages their client to go after the most, but they have to advise their client of what the options are and what they believe the result would be if it were in court and what they believe they're entitled to. And that can certainly be as much encouragement as if they said, go after him and get it all, you know, just by telling them information. And yet the attorney's ethically obligated to do that, you know, as an attorney, as an advocate. So, again, it's as much the system sometimes as the individuals participating in it that feeds into that sense of heightening the conflict process. You know, I will say, and I know, Susan, you and I were talking about this the other day, my experience, which is limited to Alaska, my experience is, though, most attorneys don't want to do divorce and custody work. They really don't. And I don't believe that any lack of referrals for mediation or encouraging of mediation, at least in this town, has to do with fears of losing business. I think it's lack of available services or lack of knowledge of what services are available. Most attorneys are only too happy to get as much of that divorce and custody work resolved by someone else, but keep the client maybe for other business, or for friendship or for other, you know, good purposes. But I just don't believe that, at least in this town, my experience is people are encouraging litigation and divorces for the sake of the business, because most of them don't want it and just don't know what else to do. one example of that is that a couple of years ago, the court system hired a court custody investigator, and that custody cases get sort of channeled through her office for some custody investigation. Attorneys were tremendously relieved to have that burden taken off of them, to have to go out and interview the witnesses and interview the children and present that custody case in all of its, you know, nuances and hurtful things. Thrilled to have somebody else doing that.
Yeah.
And I do believe they would be thrilled to have good mediation services available or other resources, whatever they're called, to help with these cases.
Let's take this opportunity to get right to the meat of the discussion, because you've set up a perfect springboard for why then mediation. Can we take a look at, and Patty, perhaps if we're trading this off one-to-one between you and Terry, why don't you take the first shot at talking about what mediation is and does. If you want to talk about what situations are best suited for it somewhere in that, that's fine too. How's the process different from the adversarial process we've described?
First, we need to do slightly, do a little definition here, and Terry, please leap in when I get to negotiation. It's a confusion on the part of many people in the public about the difference between arbitration, mediation, and negotiation. And although there are a variety of methods for doing each of these things, arbitration is when two parties in conflict agree to have a third neutral party hear evidence from both sides, and then the arbitrator, that third neutral party, makes a decision which is going to be binding on everyone, and they make that decision on their own. Negotiation, of course, can be simple, negotiating between two children, but it can be very complex. Complex labor negotiations are the thing that people most often hear about. They're professional negotiators, and they're basically hired to negotiate on behalf of one or the other party. I mean, if you're a negotiator for the union or a negotiator for the employer. But again, it's a give-and-take process, and depends on how complex the issues are as to how complex the process is. That's pretty simplification of negotiation.
And is the difference here between, say, an attorney as an advocate and a negotiator as an advocate, is that the negotiator is working towards the solution, where the attorney is working towards the best cut for his or her person?
If I can jump in here, I think the difference is more who you're dealing with. The arbitration situation is sort of judge-like. You have a
right.
Third person deciding for you. The difference maybe is you have some input into choosing who's going to be the deciding person, whereas with the judge, they're there and all disputes are submitted to that person. The negotiating process, I think, that's different than the attorney situation is the combatants, so to speak, are dealing with each other. And they may have advocates, but then the advocate's dealing with the other advocate, and there's not some higher power intervening there that's going to decide. So in court, you've got the two advocates or the two combatants appealing to this third person, and you know, with all of their advocacy skills. And I think that's the real important difference, is who you're dealing with.
Okay.
Now, finally, when one mediates a dispute, or when I mediate a dispute, my definition of mediation is that I've got no vested interest in the outcome. I'm not an advocate for either party. I am there to try and help them work through a process and make sure that all of the elements of the dispute are openly considered, that we have done what Terry indicated at the first, which is to find out the real source of the conflict. How many of us have had fights with our spouses about wet towels on the bathroom floor when, in fact, we are talking about a lack of attention or a lack of consideration over the last few weeks? It's not about the towels at all. And so it's my job as a mediator to make sure that we've really defined the conflict, that both people understand it, that they've each heard each other in terms of their own individual points of view, and we can go into that more specifically later, and that they develop together with my neutral help, hopefully, a shared solution that they own, that they've devised once they have a shared understanding of the sources of the conflict and the options involved.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I could add too much to the definition of mediation to that. I mean, you clearly are a third person, but you are a facilitator of their reaching their own solution to their own problem, you know, and both demonstrating skills within the process, also maybe laying the groundwork for them having skills to carry out for later conflict resolution. Both of those things can be happening. But your role as a mediator is not to be the problem solver. you know, and even to the extent that some suggestions are thrown out, you know, that's got to be real carefully weighed, because you may not have the information to throw out the solutions and the suggestions. But you have to have the skills to draw from them, mm-hmm. and their own knowledge of their needs and their abilities and their resources, you know, what solutions are possible for them, and then facilitate them working with it. But it's a real different role than being a judge or a judge-like person.
The wonderful thing about those of us who've had a lot of experience with mediation is that because it is authored by the disputants, the solution is authored by them when it's done well and done skillfully, it's an enduring settlement. They devised it. If I've done enough reality testing and if we have done all the groundwork together and they come up with a shared solution, it's likely to be enduring. It is not going to be the kind of situation where there's a loss of face, someone has lost a competitive process, and therefore is going to come around and try to get you again in the future over some other issue. Both parties in a good mediated settlement should have a strong investment in making sure that that settlement endures.
I have a left-turn question here, and we can bring ourselves back to the road immediately after you two respond, but I keep wondering, why, if mediation is such a good idea, and you both present it as being a very good idea for many kinds of disputes that may not fit in other resources, why this country hasn't embraced and run with it? Is it because we are still independent woodsmen going to do it by ourselves in our own perceptions? Is it because we are so competitively minded that an idea of reaching a shared solution is repugnant to us? Or is it just lack of awareness?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons, and the one that comes to mind isn't necessarily the reason or even the most important reason, but I think it's just like many things that our society has rejected old forms of doing things, and we've tried out supposedly new and modern ways of doing things, and we're coming back around to realizing that some of those old ways weren't so bad after all. And it's a sorting process, that some of the things we've had to change our way of doing things, and we're going to have to keep doing it that way. But there's some old-fashioned methods that we've had to realize in a lot of areas of our lives aren't so bad after all, and we're trying them again. But at this point, they're unfamiliar to us. We have gotten familiar and comfortable with throwing everything to the court system. You know, I'm going to take you to court over this, I'm going to take you to court over that. And we haven't caught up yet with the idea that we now have overburdened and overloaded our courts, as I said earlier, both in volume and in types of things. So I think it's a lack of familiarity. And it's just like in medicine or other areas, it takes a while for the need is there and somebody's got to come in and fill it, and then people have to get comfortable with using it and have some demonstrated track record that it can work. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's just one area of thinking.
I do think that we're a very competitive society, competitive versus cooperative. We are rewarded by our ability to compete successfully for jobs, for prizes. It starts very early. To use a gender example, two young boys in the playground get into a fight over something. People actually encourage them to fight it out. Stand up for your rights.
Win.
Yeah. And it's a way of conflict resolution that, in fact, requires fewer skills. I mean, I will say that. I mean, if the conflict is verbal and you're not verbally skilled, you're at a disadvantage. But it doesn't require thinking about things as deeply as mediation requires. It can be a purely emotional response, and it doesn't require pulling it apart. And a lot of people aren't very skilled at pulling things apart. What are the sources of this conflict? A lot of people aren't very good at communicating in the fullest sense, that what's sort of become a cliche now of active listening. We talk to each other all the time. I mean, in fact, we are barraged in this society with information on the radio, on TV. We now have faxes, so we write to each other constantly. The university, it distresses me, the amount of memo writing that goes on. And that requires us to code. We code our messages when we send them, whether it's written communication or verbal. And the other person has their own set of nuance of meaning for those words in that memo, those words in that verbal communication. So we're constantly coding and decoding, and there's a lot of possibility that we might lose things in translation. And the more we're such an information age, the more information we receive, the more likely we are to be translating some of that in incorrectly. And it really requires us to slow down and not just take things at face value.
I think another area of answer to the question of why we don't do it more is that it's not a catch-all perfect solution either. Mm. I don't believe that mediation is the answer for every kind of conflict resolution. There's not too many types of conflict that wouldn't be susceptible to mediation of some kind, but there's a lot of groups of people or pairs of people that might not be good candidates for mediation. So it's again, it's one on the menu of conflict solving devices that I'd like to see more used and more available, but it's not really ever, I don't think, going to substitute for, wipe out the court system, yeah. Wipe out playground fights, wipe out, you know, anything. It's just another tool that can take care of a lot of kinds. But one of the things I think is real important and may get us back to the road here, I don't know, is who's a good candidate for mediation. And that's something I think needs to be identified very early on in the process as well. Because the people are arriving at their own solution, there's got to be some sense of equality or parity between the two of them to participate in that process. And if they're really, truly not, there's a great disparity in power, they may really not be candidates for good mediation.
In part because whatever resolution they might come to in the room, they may not be able to carry on out, right?
Well, absolutely. There's been a lot of conversation concerning examples of domestic violence, for example, that there's a lot of resistance, and I would, it's just my private personal opinion, but I would quite agree. If someone has been beaten regularly in a relationship, the power differential in that relationship, they might sit at a table and they might, on the face of it, agree. But if the person who's been beaten in that relationship is too far down, they may be agreeing out of fear. They may be agreeing out of coercion or very low self-esteem, and so it's in fact not a mediated settlement. Let's use another example. If you have a big corporation like Exxon and some small community group that's been impacted by an act on the part of that company, a mediated settlement may not be the best approach because the power differential there is so great that the chances of coercing or forcing the more powerless group to give in to too much is really great. So,
both power differential and criminal issues have come up as non-candidates for a mediated situation. Are those the only ones the two of you would think of?
If one or both parties are unwilling to mediate, it has to be a voluntary process.
Okay.
I mean, if people are not willing to work together to solve the problem, it's not going to be successful. I've mediated situations where there's been initial resistance, and once we've gone through the process and I've explained it, they've come around and been very effective participants in the process. So I'm not saying just because you don't embrace it initially doesn't necessarily mean that it can't be mediated, but if it's not voluntary, it's not going to work.
Well, I think also in the family law area, you need to get past people's confusion of counseling, marriage counseling, and mediation. I mean, people kind of think if you're going to somebody other than the court system, you're going in for counseling. Some people have that resistance to mm-hmm. want to participate in that process. And, you know, the mediation that I'm talking about to resolve division of property, or, for example, in a divorce, is not marriage counseling. I neither have the skills for that, nor are the participants there for that. There's somebody else who might be able to do that. Again, that may require them both to be voluntarily participating. But this is a problem-solving device for people who acknowledge they have a problem and are committed to reaching some solution. I mean, that's the other another important ingredient. There has to be a commitment to solving it or reaching some resolution of it, even if at the outset they don't have a commitment to reaching the same goal. They both have to want it resolved. And you may not have that working in some situations.
We're talking today with Terry Brimner, the voice you just heard, in family law, private practice as an attorney in Fairbanks, and with Patty Kostelic, Director of Student Affairs at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and a mediator for this institution, both officially and sometimes unofficially. Our subject is mediation. I want to talk. You just said, Terry, that a mediator is not a counselor, is not a therapist. On the other hand, there are some relatively therapeutic roles. If, for example, my boss and I come in, or maybe one of us comes in to talk about a situation that needs mediating, and we have been embattled for the last 18 months. If, for example, my spouse and I, partner and I, come in and we have been embattled for the same amount of time, there's no way in the world that we're going to be able to get to the end of the situation, a resolution, without some explosion, I suppose, or some venting of the problem that has beset us over this time. Yes, no? And isn't that appropriate?
Of course, but there's a real distinction between understanding an issue perhaps better than you've ever understood it before and being in therapy in some kind of formal sense. What happens in mediation, now let me speak not from an attorney point of view, not in divorce, but in workplace conflict, which is the thing that I do at the university. Let me use a sort of hybrid example that I use when I train. It's not a specific case, but it has elements of the kinds of things that I work with so that people can get a better idea. An employee has received a reprimand from the supervisor and believes her job to be threatened and feels that she is being very wronged and threatens to grieve. We have a grievance process in place. That person comes in, and I say, okay, what's been going on? What's been happening here? In this hybrid example that I'm going to use for you, it's a fairly new supervisor who has a lot of management experience from another institution, but inherited this work group fairly recently. This is just an example. So the secretary, admin assistant, has worked for the university for a long time, has a strong and good work record, and believes herself to be very caring about the work product and does not understand and feels sort of persecuted by this reprimand. When we got into the situation, and as I really want to underscore that this is I've pulled parts of a number of situations, so this isn't describing anybody specifically. It turns out that the woman who is the admin assistant, in fact, had been recently divorced, had a child who was having chronic ear problems, and so had been showing up late by necessity because she needed to take the child to a babysitter rather than let the child get the bus for school, was feeling a lot of financial pressure, and had a work style, it turns out, that was very chaotic to the new supervisor. In other words, a desk that was sort of piled high with papers, and she knew where everything was, but the supervisor did not. And so when she was gone, either out for the whole day because of the sick child or late, and there was pressure on the rest of the office to have information, no one could find it. The supervisor was blown away by the fact that this person was feeling that grievance was a process that should be employed. I mean, it's like threatening litigation. It becomes really public. She took it as an attack of her management skills and didn't understand why this person was overreacting. When we really got down to it, it's that the employee who received the reprimand, she really felt that her job was threatened, and that was a safety and security life life issue, and so it wasn't like about the mess on her desk or about a few latenesses. To her, it really felt like her job was threatened. They had not been communicating effectively, so we sat down first separately, and I, through asking opening questions, then what happened, and what did she say, and what did you say, and are you sure it was this way, and so on, they were capable of working out a very good solution that did not involve one of them leaving the workplace. And after all, there is real incentive to find a solution to the problem if one or the other of them is not going to leave the workplace. I mean, if they're going to have to continue to work together, it is really in their own best interest, in both of their own best interests, to work out a solution. And in this case, it was to modify the work hours, which were in the power of the supervisor in this case to do, because she did have other coverage, and to develop jointly a filing system so that other people could access the work when she needed to be away, and an agreement to sit down on a regular basis and talk about the projects that they were working on, rather than sort of catching each other as catch can, that there were lots of parts of the work that they really hadn't discussed. And so they were both working in information vacuums, which is frequently a problem with conflict.
In this case, to make it very short, both people are right,
mm-hmm.
and the truth is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's a values conflict there. I mean, the new supervisor was valuing punctuality, neatness. These were important values. If you care about the work, you would be on time and you would be neat, right?
And that's the response is, I care so much about the work, even with a sick child and this problem and that problem, I'm getting it done.
And to the other person, they weren't late because they didn't care about the work, and they weren't messy because they didn't care about the work. It's a work style. It's a different kind of value, aesthetic. Doesn't necessarily change the outcome of the products that result from a working day.
Terry, even in a divorce situation, is it important to, as Patty was just describing, sustain the relationship?
Exactly. I was thinking that while she was talking, that divorce, you know, ends a relationship. You know, people think, well, this relationship's no good, I can get divorced. Well, in fact, especially if there's children, you are not divorced until, maybe not till death do you part, but certainly till the children are of age, and probably at least till they're married. You have to have a continuing relationship with that other parent of some kind. If they're a real involved, active parent, and you've got sharing of custody, then you're going to have a fairly intense relationship even after the divorce. Even if they're just a parent who lives in another state and sees the children during the summer and alternate Christmases or telephones, there's some level of relationship that continues. And yet, here's the ingredients. You've had the breakdown of an intimate relationship, a marriage, which means, you know, these people have profound differences that couldn't be resolved within the marriage. You know, the task there to have a working relationship with those areas where they still have to deal with each other, you know, is enormous. But the situation, the same as Patty was talking about, this supervisor and this administrative assistant have to continue working in the same environment. So some resolution and some restructuring of that relationship is necessary. And the thing that mediation, and I think as well as litigation, needs to keep in mind with divorces, and going back to the fact of why, one of the reasons why that doesn't fit neatly into our traditional model of conflict resolution in the court system, is because of this ongoing situation. If I injure you in a car accident and you sue me for damages because you lost your leg and your eyesight, for example, and the jury hears all the evidence and they find me responsible and they set an amount of money and I pay you, granted, your problems continue, but yours and my relationship is over.
Mm-hmm.
That conflict is resolved by my payment of money for my responsibility. But when there's a divorce situation and the judge has pronounced the decree, those people still have to walk out of the courtroom and somehow implement it. And one of the things in talking about the difficulties of the role of the attorney here, your role as a zealous advocate sometimes can get in the way of setting this person up to be in a working relationship with the other party after you're long gone, you're out of the picture. They don't have you as an advocate anymore. They're out there on their own. And as Patty pointed out in one of her examples, you can't set this person up to have an enemy when you're out of the picture. You can't use your skills in such a way that you beat the other person so far down that you've just created the first shot of the next battle. And yet, you know, there's potentially a conflict with your ethical obligations to advocate for that client. In mediation, you still have to be aware of that. But I think that the tools you've got to work with are a lot more flexible. But it's the same concept. These are people that have to get along after this conflict is resolved, for the most part, most of the time. And you've got to be laying the groundwork for that, as well as solving the immediate problem that brought them in the door.
Patty.
That takes me to something that there are lots of different ways of thinking about this, and so people who have read Getting to Yes or Principles of Negotiation, there is different vocabulary and a different way of sort of pulling this out. For the people that I work with, I try to get them to separate out the interests. Okay, in the example I used, it would be the interest of keeping this current employment in a way that doesn't give me an ulcer. In examples that Terry's been using, continuing a positive relationship with my children, even though they may be spending time with my ex husband or wife. So the interests that need to be satisfied, which is the sort of why of the conflict, if you will, need to be separated from the what. What is the issue? The issue being the wet towels on the bathroom floor, or where are the kids going to go, or how much furniture am I going to get versus what you get, or my 15-minute latenesses. Those are the issues. They aren't the whys, they are the whats of the conflict. And until you get those two things sorted out, you can't get to the how are we going to resolve this, the position. I mean, we talk about position-based bargaining. But the how only comes out after we've sorted out the interests from the issues. And the interests, as Terry indicated, frequently require that we do some face-saving, that we do some validating of my beliefs and my values, even if you don't agree with them. That's okay. It's not that we have to get to the point where we have the same values, but we do need to work toward understanding what those values are. What are my interests? What are your interests? And how are those different before we can probably work on a shared solution?
So I may need to say to you, and you may need to hear, that you're running around on me in this relationship has taken me to the breaking point, or your inability to see that I need a wage and deserve a wage increase is taking me to the breaking point in terms of my job. Yes? That is what you're talking about that is very important.
Well, the running around may not, that may be the what. that may be the issue, but it may not be the interest. I mean, I guess my personal experience would say that there may be people who just are who have affairs, even though they're ecstatically happy with their relationship. I'm not saying that isn't possible. Obviously, I'm sure it is. But in most instances, there's been a problem with the relationship before the affair occurs. So I guess I take it back
so
and
you go
say
farther back,
farther back. To something that's fairly basic as being the interest. What is in my long-term best interest? And as it applies to divorces, I may have to give up some furniture. I may have to give up some of these tangible goods in order to serve my long-term best interest, which is ongoing communication with my ex-spouse in order to benefit the children and their stability and their mental happiness.
But I think one of the things that Susan was, pointing out with her question is that those things are still sitting there like great big barriers to getting to where you can even identify what your long-term issues are.
It's elephant
and
in the living room.
Somehow need to be dealt with. And if they're so enormous, going back to the question of counseling versus mediating, there may need to be some counseling and therapy that takes place first before they can get into mediation. You know, sometimes that's not necessary, but somehow dealt with. And one of the things that I know, again, the court system, particularly, let's just take Alaska law on divorce, can't handle that. Alaska's what's called a no-fault divorce state. You can get divorced for incompatibility of temperament, and everybody does. So that being the case, in the strict legal terminology and framework and model, it is irrelevant that someone ran around on somebody else. But you try telling the two people involved that it is irrelevant that there were affairs. It is relevant to them, but it's not relevant to the court. So that never gets talked about. Someone comes into my office and tells me their husband was having affairs and therefore they want more property. I have to tell them right then and there.
The court doesn't care.
Yeah. The judge personally cares. I personally care. The system doesn't care, and we'll never talk about it again. you know, and so that person is left sitting there with this big lump of hurt mm-hmm. that is affecting their ability. We talk about division of property. That's a big issue in a divorce. In Alaska, the law is that property will be divided equitably or fairly. Doesn't say what percentage you automatically get. It's fair. Well, fair could be 50-50, but maybe to the person who's been hurt very badly in the relationship or physically abused or run around on, fair, you know, has nothing to do with the mathematical percentage. Sometimes in the mediation process, those other issues that get in the way of reaching the same result that the court is going to reach, you have to reach a fair division of your property in mediation. You have to reach an interest, a custody plan that's in the best interest of the child, same as the court is. You have the same standards. But I think you have more room within that mediation process to deal with these real issues, or I think you have another word for it, Patty. I might be picking the wrong one. But there are the real issues to the people
interests.
Involved, interests,
mm-hmm.
Because they
the
are...
The whys of the conflict.
Right. Mm-hmm. But you've, again, got to be real careful to draw the lines between when this becomes a therapy issue, the abuse, or the lack of self-esteem because of years of the other spouse having affairs, or whatever the issue is. You have to be real alert as a mediator to see if this is a therapy or counseling issue that's beyond the scope of what you're doing to reach a joint agreement and a settlement of it. But you don't have to ignore them, as the court system is bound to ignore them.
When I do workplace mediation, sometimes we identify some values or beliefs that in fact may be working against the person's ability to be a satisfactory or outstanding employee. I can't address those. We can identify them. We can say these kinds of work habits are contributing, according to your supervisor or your coworkers, to ongoing conflict in the work situation. But the person is going to have to ultimately decide whether they want to change those habits that are based on their own beliefs. Punctuality, if it's just not at all important to me, even though it may be causing me problems, I mean, I have to make a choice as an individual whether I'm going to alter that mm-hmm. or not. I don't attempt to put judgment on the various styles or beliefs of the people involved. I mean, there may be things that make it easier to get along in life, but that's up to the person whether they're going to act on that or not. It indeed might be something in certain instances where it's cultural, deeply mm-hmm. held belief that the way to resolve an issue is not to be verbally aggressive, is to sit silently. That can solve problems, but I'm not the one who suggests that therefore you should become verbal or therefore you should become silent. I mean, that's something that the people need to decide.
We're talking with Patty Kostelic and Terry Foster Brimner today, and our subject is mediation on Sunday at Noon. I'm Susan McInnes. Is there an aspect in a mediator's role, I can't think of what to call it, I think of it as grasping the nettle, where the mediator may be the one who says, yes, I know you want this huge thing as settlement for your dispute, or you want to reach this major resolution, but you may only be able to reach this resolution in this area, who helps people see not only what the issues are, but what the realities of the situation and the settlement might be?
Well, I thought of two things when you were phrasing the question. One is sometimes within the context of mediation, you break down, there's more than one conflict, especially in something complicated like a divorce, and you may not be able to solve all of them through the mediation process. That's one way of looking at it. The other one is, again, to condense down, get away some of the things that are sort of irrelevant or clouding the issue, and just mm-hmm. more clearly identify the issue for resolution somewhere else. But I think it's often possible in mediation of divorce issues to perhaps be able to mediate the property settlement and not the custody thing, you know, to have such distinct problems that one can be mediated and one can't, or to be able to narrow the issues of dispute and more carefully define them to present to some other tribunal, whether it be the court or a grievance process or something else. I think both of those things can happen. And the mediator could certainly be a part of helping that process take place, I think.
We haven't talked very much about what the process consists of, and obviously there are probably a lot of ways of handling this, but I think we should just sort of outline for people what the elements are, and if Terry does it slightly differently, she can chime in here. The first thing that I always want to do is allow the parties to ventilate and really, in their own words, get out all the things that they're feeling and thinking and all of the proofs or information that they have, so that I can discover where the discrepancy in information or viewpoint is. And it's very important in that part of the process, when I can, to have the person that they're in conflict with, the other party, restate those statements, just so that they are assured that they've really been heard. It's not necessary to agree, but it's really frustrating if you say something and somebody either doesn't hear or refuses to acknowledge that they've heard what your point of view is, both effectively, emotionally, and cognitively or intellectually. So that's the first part. Then to get the parties to agree to, in fact, what are the issues here and how can they be broken down. And very often people throw in a lot of irrelevant things that are just sort of heaping onto the problem that, in fact, they can agree upon fairly easily if you pull them away from the issues that are at the heart of the real conflict. So we try to articulate or list the things that are at conflict. Sometimes it involves some caucusing, and Terry probably does this, to meet with the parties separately and individually to make sure that they're finding a way to say all the things they need to say and that they aren't holding back and having some kind of hidden thing that, in fact, is going to later cause problems. Then by asking very open questions, you need to get them to figure out some possible solutions for the problem. And finally, your task as mediator is to do some reality testing, which is what you were talking about. Can this really work? How is this going to exactly happen? When you do this, what's this person going to do? Mm-hmm. Is it possible, given the reality of your life and your resources, to meet the commitments you're making? So that reality testing is very important. You don't want people to agree to something just so they can get out of the room and then find they can't make it happen.
I was going to ask you before we left, both of you, to give thoughts to some helpful practical thoughts to people who might be listening, and I think you've made a good start at that list, Patty, actually, for people, whether they're in mediation or not, what needs to be done to help to get to a resolution. Terry, we're short on time, about 2 minutes before we need to move to this afternoon's opera presentation. Your last thoughts on the subject, or if you'd just like to move from what Patty...
No, I think I would just reinforce the last thing that Patty said would be a good way to end it, and that is, you know, for lack of a better term, reality testing what's happened. And I think the mediator can provide a very important role there to throw out a lot of what-ifs. You know, if you're skilled and knowledgeable in your area that you're mediating in, you know what the common problems are going to be, you know what the common pitfalls and areas where things fall apart. And throw those out and work through the what-if scenarios as well to test its future durability as well as having resolved the immediate presenting problem. And I think that's almost as important as just about getting to some resolution of the problem. It also does sort of go back to step one and validate whether you've made a good evaluation that these people are good candidates for mediation, because to be a good candidate, you have to be willing to not only have the skills to come to the decision, but take responsibility for that decision. Nobody else is going to tell you what to do. And then can you do it?
Mm-hmm. As I'm listening, I'm thinking we can use these skills also on our own, yes?
Absolutely.
And I'm not far off when I say that?
Absolutely. Any analysis of conflicts that you're in, instead of just letting your gut grind around and being angry, if you can back off from it a little bit and think, why are we having this conflict?
Why is my
stomach grinding? Are we communicating? Do we have the same facts and same information? Is it in my interest and their interest to sit down and have a talk and resolve this? And to me, the real key is communication. I mean, you really need to make sure that you are coding and decoding the messages received and sent in a way that's the same for the other people.
Clear, not adding your own baggage.
Right.
Terry Foster Brimner, Patty Kostelic, thanks so much for an interesting hour. We've been talking about mediation on Sunday at noon. Next week, Charlotte Rowe and I are going to sit down. Charlotte Rowe is a seismologist for the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and we're going to talk about earthquakes. It's been 25 years since what we call the Great One in Alaska. We're due, folks. So we'll talk about earthquakes in Alaska. I'm Susan McInnes for Sunday at Noon. Good afternoon.